Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
CBS Mornings. It's another Monday. I'm Gail King.
I'm Tony DeCopel.
And I'm Nate Burleson. We're going to begin actually with a tough story out of Montana, an investigation into what caused a deadly derailment in a beautiful stretch of that state. At least three people are killed, dozens more injured in the accident. Some cars jumped off the tracks. All of it happened near the town of Joplin. It's an Amtrak route from Chicago to Seattle. Federal investigators are there, and so is our Meg Oliver. Meg, good morning. As I said, this is a gorgeous part of the country, and it was a beautiful day when this happened. Mile for mile, rail travel is supposed to be very safe. What happened?
Tony, good morning. The Liberty County Sheriff said he is still working on identifying the relatives of those who died. Experts say derailments where cars flip over like this one are incredibly rare, and this comes just days after an inspection of the tracks in the area.
Oh my God, it's on its side. Oh, the train's destroyed down there.
Social media video from Survivor showed the terrifying moments after an Amtrak Empire Builder train derailed Saturday in north central Montana, killing at least three and injuring dozens more. Rail cars were tossed on their sides, passengers stranded and luggage scattered in the wake. The westbound train was on its way from Chicago to Seattle when it derailed near Joplin, Montana. It was carrying approximately 141 passengers and 17 crew members.
I was laying down in my compartment on a bed, so luckily I just tumbled in the room.
Andrew Savula was headed from Chicago to Portland.
I heard a loud bang, and then the car tipped.
Wayne Freed was switching cars when the derailment happened.
I was lucky in that I was able to grab a hold of the coffee table, and I just held on to that, and my legs were dangling down below, and the windows broke out down below, and which is how we eventually escaped after the train stopped.
There were routine inspections just days before this tragedy on the tracks.
This section of track was last inspected on September 23rd as part of BNSF's regular inspection program.
Former NTSB Chairman Robert Sumwalt says the tracks will be just one area of focus in the investigation.
So if you were on the ground here, what would you be looking for?
They'll be looking at three primary things. They'll be looking at the operation of the train. Was the locomotive engineer properly controlling the train? What is the condition of the track? Is there anything about the track itself that could have led to a derailment? And finally, the mechanical condition of the train. Was there anything with the train that could have led to a derailment?
The NTSB says once they determine what caused this accident, they are committed to taking action to prevent anything similar in the future. Sumwalt also tells me investigators will be looking at what led to the injuries and fatalities and whether seatbelts could have prevented them. Nate?
Meg, thank you. Today, Congress starts a week of debate that could make or break President Biden's domestic agenda. Democrats plan to have crucial votes on two bills that demonstrate the party's priorities at the cost of trillions of dollars in spending. Nancy Cortez is at the White House. Nancy, good morning.
Good morning, Nate. Well, this is the centerpiece of President Biden's platform, and it is all coming to a head this week. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she is aiming to hold a vote on a bipartisan infrastructure plan on Thursday, but that all hinges on her ability to round up the votes for a second spending bill that is three times as large.
This is the vision of the president.
Democrats had a warning for a potential holdout Sunday. The president's priorities are on the line this week.
This is the president's Democratic agenda.
It's a key part of the president's agenda.
This is Joe Biden's bill.
Joe Biden's bill is a huge $3.5 trillion package that includes new funding for the child tax credit, universal pre-K, home health care, and much more.
We'll keep government open.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says 95% of House Democrats are now on board. But with such a slim majority, her party will need to do even better than that.
If somebody wants less than $3.5 trillion, tell us what you want to cut. Do you want to cut the child care? Do you want to cut paid leave? What is it you want to cut?
The margin for victory is narrow because Democrats cannot count on any Republican support.
They are in the midst of an absolutely unprecedented, very damaging spending spree on a scale that we have never seen.
A small breakthrough came last night when two more centrist House Democrats announced they now support passage of the package.
I'm optimistic about this week. It's going to take the better part of the week, I think.
Without a deal on this bill, progressives are vowing to hold up another big Biden bill, the bipartisan infrastructure package worth another $1.2 trillion that would go towards rebuilding roads and bridges.
This is Washington. I'm sure there's going to be some kind of compromise.
Democrats have imposed this deadline on themselves to try to get this all done this week because they know that the longer this drags on, the more likely it is that problems start to pop up. And it only gets more difficult to pass major legislation like this, Gail, the closer we get to next year's midterm elections.
Got it, Nancy. Thank you very much. Today marks the start of a major test for vaccine mandates all around the country. While New York City's mandate for teachers to be vaccinated was put on hold by a federal judge, the mandate for the state's healthcare workers is going into effect. Now, those workers must now have at least one dose, and that's leading to fears of staffing shortages. An estimated 72,000 hospital workers are not yet fully vaccinated statewide, and that's about 16% of the workforce. We're joined now by Dr. Ashish Jha. He's dean of Brown University School of Public Health. Good morning to you, Dr. Jha. It's always good to see you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back.
Okay, let's start with the vaccine hesitancy among the medical workers. Because if I was a non-vaccinated person and I see healthcare workers are not getting vaccinated, I would think, do they know something that I don't? How do you explain the vaccine hesitancy among that group of people?
Yeah, so Gail, the way I remind people is that 97, maybe 98% of all doctors are vaccinated, 80, 90% of nurses are vaccinated. So there really isn't a lot of hesitancy. It's a very small group. They're very noisy, they're very loud, and they make it look like lots of healthcare workers are hesitant, but they really aren't. Most healthcare workers have gotten the shot already.
Okay, that's really good to know because you're right. They're very loud and they're very noisy and they get a lot of attention. Now here in New York, there is a plan possibly to call in the National Guard health workers to fill in for some of the shortages. What do you think of that? And have you ever heard of such a thing?
Yeah, the shortages are being caused by the fact that we've had this massive surge in the South. And so what that has actually meant is pulled nurses away from New England, New York, Mid-Atlantic, Midwest states to the South. That is really causing a major part of the problem. I don't think vaccine mandates are the source of the shortage, but it is unprecedented to have, National Guard coming in to help. But this is the crisis we're in, and as long as the infection continues to rage in many places in the country, we're going to need stopgap measures like this.
Can we talk about the Dr. Wachelle Walensky's decision where she went against her board? We talked about it briefly last week and she's still defending her decision. What do you make of the difference between the two?
Yeah, I actually thought she made the right call, and I didn't think it was actually a close call. You know, the advisory committee, and it's just an advisory committee, said that they did not see evidence that high-risk healthcare workers, people who are on the front lines, needed to get a booster yet. I disagree. I see the data as showing that they do. And Dr. Walensky clearly reads the data in the same way. And this is her prerogative. She is the appointed head of the CDC. So I thought she made the right decision.
But then again, you then have the problem again of the mixed messages. And I think the last thing people need who have not been vaccinated is to get mixed messages.
I totally agree, Gail. I mean, look, the messaging on this has not been as clear as it should be. Here's the way I would think about it. First of all, absolutely essential right now that people get their first shots. If you've not been vaccinated, my goodness, you've got to go out and get vaccinated. If you are 6 months out from your second shot and you're in any kind of a high-risk group or a high-risk profession, the evidence is coming in that you probably should get a booster. And that's basically the message that we should be saying. Get the first shot if you haven't. Get a booster if you're in a high-risk situation. I think that's where the evidence is.
I can't wait to get the booster. I will try not to trample little children on the way to get in line. Thank you very much, Dr. Ashish Jha.
Yeah, thank you.
I won't, I promise. Thank you, sir, for your time.
Turning now to the investigation into the murder of Gabby Petito. Over the weekend, a memorial was held near her childhood home here in New York. Petito disappeared while on a cross-country road trip with her fiancé, Brian Laundrie. National correspondent Jerika Duncan has been following this for us. Jerika. Good morning.
Good morning to you. A lot of people attended that memorial. Family, friends, and those touched by Gabby Petito's story mourned her loss this weekend. Yesterday, hundreds of people lined up at a Long Island funeral home to pay their respects to Petito. Some waited at least an hour delivering the eulogy. Petito's father, Joe, said he couldn't be more proud as a father.
Gabby is the most amazing person I've ever met. So if you're going to leave here today, I'm asking that you guys be inspired by the way she treated people, all people.
Brian Laundrie, Gabby Petito's fiance, was not mentioned, but Petito's father said he received emails from around the country from people who said they were in toxic relationships. And in an apparent reference to Laundrie, said, if there's a relationship that you're in that might not be the best thing for you, leave it now. The manhunt for Laundrie continues today after an exhaustive search, and a Florida nature reserve has so far turned up no clues. The FBI, though, has an arrest warrant for Laundrie. Yesterday, they returned to his parents' home for personal items they need for DNA matching.
Mm. Yeah, now, Jerika, so you've been covering this case for us in 48 hours. Yeah. What else stood out to you? What else caught your eye?
You know, the obvious question is, where is Brian Laundrie? Everyone wants to know, and how did, you know, we get here? But what stood out to me, actually, was the close connection with the family. You know, the father, the biological father, made a point to say Gabby didn't have, you know, two parents. She had four, mm-hmm. referencing the step-parents. But just talking about the amount of love that she had for them and that they had for her. And, I mean, we knew early on when we interviewed them last week, they were advocates as a unit, all four of them. Mm-hmm. So I think to see the strength that they're able to exude to get through this really difficult time is really amazing.
I thought it was touching, too, that the father took that time to encourage people to get out of abusive relationships.
Yes.
Considering what his daughter went through, and many in the family and her friends didn't seem to know that it was as bad as it appears to be.
Right.
What we're learning about that
relationship. And just his overall message to live.
Yes.
You know, you don't know. Tomorrow's not promised. And just, man, I was so impressed by how well they kept it together at that memorial service and speaking about her. But what an incredible young woman.
Yeah.
Jerika, thank you so much. Now, in our next hour, we'll look at why some missing persons cases like Gabby Petito's draw so much attention and why others are ignored.
Overseas now, an election in Germany yesterday is set to decide the future of that country and possibly all of Europe. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who dominated German politics for 16 years, is stepping down. A more liberal government is likely to replace her, but we still don't know when. Chris Livesay is in Berlin. Chris, very narrow election. Three parties can claim some portion of leadership. What more do we know? Good morning.
Well, good morning, Tony. We are still weeks, if not months, away from finding out who the next German chancellor will be as the focus now shifts to forming a coalition government. But no matter who the candidate is, well, they're virtually falling over themselves to prove who most closely resembles Angela Merkel.
After 16 years in office, Angela Merkel, a former research scientist and daughter of a Lutheran preacher, is finally saying Auf Wiedersehen as German chancellor. Lauded as a bulwark of Europe, helping save it from imploding during the 2009 debt crisis. Her secret? A stoic calm that didn't just influence German society, it defined it, says political scientist Frank Staus.
So there is a lot of common sense, if you want to, in the German public, and she, maybe even due to her.
Her legacy spanned four presidencies, befriending some, clashing with former President Trump. As he retreated from international affairs, many looked to Angela Merkel as the new leader of the free world, says political analyst David Deissner.
I think the Trump years made clear
that the Western values do not necessarily only have to be represented by the United States. I think this is why many people said that she was really carrying the torch of Western values and freedom.
Very
While Trump wanted migrants out,
I will build a great, great wall.
Merkel opened Germany's doors to more than 1 million refugees, her shining moment, according to most Germans.
It was a good thing, but then the question is how you deal with it.
Indeed, there was a backlash. On Merkel's watch, a far-right party entered parliament for the first time since World War II. And anti-migrant movements took hold across Europe. In Hungary, they erected a fence. Once Time magazine's Person of the Year, she now leaves the reins of the most powerful country in Europe, as well as many of the tensions she sought to resolve.
Now the center left is narrowly ahead of Angela Merkel's center right, but that is hardly a rebuke. Their candidate, Olaf Scholz, is Angela Merkel's own finance minister, who not only exudes that same sense of calm, he even uses some of Merkel's hand gestures. Nate?
Chris Lipsey in Germany, thank you.
Stephen Colbert here to tell you about the Late Show Pod Show, which is our podcast for the Late Show with my producer, Becca. Becca, how long have you been producing this podcast?
I've been producing this podcast for 2 years now.
And your favorite thing about it?
The extended moments, for sure.
Right, because sometimes I'll interview like a big star for 25 minutes, and we can only put like 14 minutes on air. Where can people get that?
On the Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert, wherever you get your podcasts.
And who produces that?
I help out. It's a team effort.